So welcome to Smart Water Solutions podcast. I am Hakim El Fadil. This is episode number 7. Today's guest is Dr. Bob Golds. Considering the shortage of fresh water resources and environmental problems, which is actually caused by oil and gas industry, produced water treatment and reuse are actually taking a lot of attention right now. And in this episode, we will learn from Bob how produced water could be a valuable product for both the oil producers and also the environmental impact. So Bob is a PhD chemist from the University of Iowa in the United States. He had more than 36 years experience at Dow Chemical.
Yeah, 38.
38 years, yeah. Experience. And now, Bob, you are working as a consultant in for the trace contaminant removal, making electronics-grade solvents and water treatments for oil and gas, and also charitable organizations, I would say. So welcome, Bob.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Nice to be with you.
Yeah. So, Bob, I have given a little bit of background about you, so why not just share with us your interesting career insider, the key things that you have learned and actually inspired you to be, let's say, loyal to the ion exchange technology and not move completely to completely different industry and different technologies. So why this technology keeps you motivated to work on?
Well, in my experience in ion exchange of a number of decades, you can really call it separation sciences. You're separating one thing from another. For a long time, I was the guy that was answering the phone. People would say they needed to separate this from that. And in some cases, we had a product that would work great to do that. And in other cases, we didn't have a solution for them. And then I had to figure out, well, is this problem worth solving? As we get a lot of calls and people that say, well, I've got a whole bunch of this I need to treat. I need to treat a gallon or a cubic meter of this solution. And of course, you've got to winnow away the opportunities that you want to spend your time on from the ones that you just can't afford to do so. So from there, it just really in the separation sciences is my background. And in the last 5 years or so at Dow, I was applying some of the products and some of the knowledge that I had to the oil and gas industry. Like you say, there's a huge amount of water that's co-produced with the oil. Sometimes it's a couple of barrels to as many as 9 or 10 barrels of water per barrel of oil. And that produced water is nasty stuff. It smells bad. It's full of hydrocarbons, and it's typically very salty. So it's a very challenging water to deal with. And I felt that that was a good place for me to apply some of what I know and focus on some of those applications.
Yeah, so when you say, produce water, just to maybe to give a clear clarification for everyone. So what do you mean by produce water? I mean, is there any classification for offshore and onshore? Is there any classification in terms of produce water quality?
Yeah, produced water is the water that comes from the ground during oil and gas production operations. Here in the United States, of course, there's lots of fracking, and they're fracking with a fluid that is has a number of different chemicals in it. And then after you've done the frack and you've placed your proppant in the frack, then you release the pressure and you have a frack flowback. And that's those chemicals that come back to the surface. And that's just arbitrarily defined by a certain amount of time or a number of volumes that come back. But eventually, it's just the water in the formation. That is the salts and minerals that have been down there for eons of time that were released by the operations so that the oil and gas can flow back to the surface.
Right. And the way, I mean, technically speaking, the way how I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, I mean, produced water has an oil content of, I mean, roughly 300 ppm and also some small percentage of small particles. I mean, 300 ppm, which means 300 parts oils for every 1 million parts of water. Am I understanding correct? Or
No, that's not quite correct. So the water that comes up from the formation will contain variable levels of solids. We call it total suspended solids, or TSS. And the type and amount will depend on the geology deep below the ground. If it's one kind of a formation, it'll be a certain particle size. If it's a different formation, it'll be a different kind. Then you asked about the oils and the hydrocarbons. Of course, as it's coming out of the ground, you're producing oil. So you might get a barrel of oil for every 3 barrels of water that's produced. And of course, oil and water would rather be separated. But because you are pumping them and sending them through lines and valves and things like that, you'll get the generation of small droplets of oil that will be suspended in the water. And then you'll go through standard recovery processes to recover as much of that oil as possible. Now, in the old days, they used mechanical equipment to do that. And in some cases, that recovery works pretty well. But in other cases, other types of oil don't separate very well. And you'll have suspended oil or entrained oil that's still in the water that haven't been removed by classical methods. And that oil can represent as much as 1 to 3% of the water. So if oil is going for $50 a barrel and you have 1% oil in that water, that means that you've got 50 cents worth of oil value in that water. And of course, you're probably producing several barrels of oil for several barrels of water per barrel of oil. So if you were 5 barrels of water per oil, you'd take that 50 cents and multiply it by 5, and you'd have $2.50 worth of oil that could be recovered for every barrel of oil that's produced. And it can be significant amounts, as you can see from that discussion.
Yeah, and I would say, I mean, typically for wells, it would be a significant amount if you do the calculation for 1 year.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
And it's been, my experience at working at Dow, a lot of people think of Dow as a chemical company, and Dow is, but we work with hydrocarbons. Our feed sources are all these hydrocarbons, and we're doing processing and all that sort of thing. So a lot of these same technologies have been used inside of Dow for decades now. And since I was the interface from the water business to Dow, I was able to take some of these technologies from inside of Dow and make them available to the industry for the industry to use, the oil and gas industry.
Yeah, which makes a lot of difference if the company itself is an end user and using that and having experience with technology. Mm-hmm. It adds a lot of value. I mean, I see that.
The issue there, though, is that it's not enough to just make the media. You know, Dow's strategy the whole time I was there was to make media. So we'd make the little round plastic beads and sell them to everyone. Now, the advantage to that is that you can be a supplier. You can have lots of customers, you can treat everybody fairly. But in this case, there is some equipment that's needed that's a little bit different, that's a little unusual. And so that was the challenge with this oil wicking resin or the oil recovery resin is that you need to have partners that who can design, engineer, and build the equipment and then offer that to end users. So the solution is not just the beads, but it's the whole package of the equipment with the beads inside and knowing how to use that technology.
All right, so when you say the whole package, you mean the expertise, how to use that technology and also the full package? This is what you mean, or?
Yeah, to design, engineer, and build the equipment. And so that's what I have done since I left the company, is that I'm allying with companies that can do that, that can design, engineer, and build and offer these full treatment systems to customers to recover oil and that sort of thing.
Right. And this brings me to a question, if I combine it with, you just said previously that the geology is different from one area to another area when you get the oil from the well. So does it mean that the set of technology will be different from one well to the other, or it will be the same for every oil, for every well?
So in an overall strategy of water treatment, there's a hierarchy. There is a series of steps that need to be done in a certain sequence. And in any water like this, the first thing you need to do is you need to filter the water to remove the TSS, the suspended solids. And the old way of doing that is with sedimentation, bag filters, all kinds of other things, coconut shell, carbon, coconut shell filters are used. And I had a wonderful experience at Dow where they developed something called a tequatic. It's a self-cleaning fine particle filter that works continuously. It has a number of advantages. It doesn't require the operators to be exposed to the benzene and the hydrocarbons when they change the bags out. There's no problems with disposal of the bags and that sort of thing. It was really a wonderful technology. And I'm working with people now that have even moved beyond the Tequatic to other filters, newer and better filters. But all those filtration techniques are available out there now in order to remove the suspended solids. So then after that, we use these wicking resins to remove the suspended oil. And then we have a third technology. If you want to remove the dissolved oil, you can also do that. So after you've done these three steps, you've really made it into salt water. You remove all the things that make it produced water, and it's just salty water. Now you can decide what you want to do with that salty water, whether you're going to deep well dispose of it, which is what happens in many places around the world. They just put it into saltwater disposal wells. It's very important that those components be removed before you dispose of it, because those components that we remove will booger up or cause problems for a disposal well. The disposal wells are wells that are drilled into the earth, and they have a bore hole, and that bore is going to feed into a receiving geology. And if you shove solids down there, those solids are going to coat the inside of that bore well and create pressure and cause problems. Same thing with the suspended oil. If that goes down there, it'll plug off the pores and prevent good reception of the water. And of course, the industry responds to that by, you know, pumping acid down and cleaning those holes, those bores. But eventually, they lose their productivity, and it can often cost you millions of dollars to drill a new disposal. So, taking good care of your disposal well is a really good idea and important. So, there's a value proposition besides recovering the oil. We have the value proposition of protecting the disposal well.
Right. So the disposal, is there no chance to recycle, to reuse that seawater, for example, in the well?
Well, let's address that. It's not just seawater, okay? Yeah. The level of dissolved solids of salt that's in there varies very, very widely. In some formations, it's saturated with salt water. And remember, these formations are very hot, so it's very high levels. It can be hundreds of parts per million of dissolved salts, 200, 300,000 parts per million of salts. In other cases, though, it can be low. And it can be only a few thousand or 10,000 parts per million. And in those cases, absolutely, that water can be treated with technology such as reverse osmosis that you and I are very familiar with. And RO can be used to recover a great deal of that water for use. Typically, it's used in for irrigation. It can be surface discharged and go into the local river or reservoir, whatever have you. And the other thing that's going on right now is that people are looking at evaporation of the salt. So they are using evaporation systems to drive off the water and make a solid out of the salt. Now, salt is pretty much a commodity chemical. It doesn't have a lot of value, but in some locations, cost of disposal of that produced water might be very high. Here in the U.S., the Marcellus is in Pennsylvania, in New Jersey, West Virginia, sorry, in the Northeast, and they have to haul that water a good distance away to get rid of it, and that hauling cost is the main cost, and so disposal can be $10 per barrel of water, and that's a lot of money, and so exploring other strategies for disposing of that water, like evaporation and make rock salt, makes a lot of sense. But again, if you're going to do that, you've got to properly pre-treat the water to remove the suspended solids and the oil and the dissolved oil in order to protect those downstream sensitive processes.
Yeah. So that's. Let me just go one step before that. I mean, to ask you about the ion exchange and Aptipore. I mean, the step that you have done a lot of job in removing or recovering the oil. Could you just share us, I mean, some technical hints and the value of that technology that you have been working with?
Yeah. I put together a paper that was presented at the Produced Water Society in 2017, where I go through all that information. It was the economics of treating produced water, I think was the title of it. And I broke all those steps down. I went through the self-cleaning fine particle filters and talked about how they work. And then pretty quickly went into the economics of their treatment And then I presented information about OPEX and CAPEX based on the experience that I and my colleagues had with that technology. And then the same thing with the wicking resin to wick out the oil. That is really very inexpensive technology. And I looked at the OPEX and CAPEX. We were looking there at a fraction of a penny per barrel of water treated. And I just mentioned earlier that depending on the level of oil present, if it's 1%, that's worth 50 cents per barrel. So less than a penny to 50 cents a barrel is a pretty attractive value proposition. And then the OptiPore for removing the dissolved hydrocarbons, that's really important if you've got some downstream processes that are going to be sensitive to the hydrocarbons, like RO. RO does not like BTEX. It doesn't like dissolved hydrocarbons, and you really need to remove those. And they can be removed for a few pennies per barrel of water that's treated. But that talk contains that information.
Right. So if I understood correctly, I mean, RO has that weakness, I would say, when it comes to the high concentration of BTEX. And also, if I understood correctly, there are some type of produced water which doesn't make economical sense to treat with
that. That's right.
Right.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And I mean, looking to your, I mean, you have been doing also this role globally, and I think you may have a better view on Middle East as well, in Qatar and Dubai. So do you think this region also has potential, you know, to treat the produced water and get some value from their produced water, or it doesn't make economical sense for them for the time being?
No, absolutely. It makes sense to go after some of these waters and treat them. For me, I sit here in the United States, and I'm not involved in those areas. I am retired. I do some work, but I didn't want to go from one full-time job to another full-time job. So I'm limiting what I do. But I'm interested in supporting people and working with them. But I'm not looking for a full-time job. I'm looking for consulting.
Right. So this brings me to the question. You said, I mean, the produced water, you have been working with Ion Exchange and OptiPore. I mean, is there any next best alternative? Is there any other technology which competes against OptiPore and Ion Exchange, and they can do the same job at the same, providing the same value?
So, sure. There are other technologies out there that will work. There are mechanical separators that have been around for 30 or 40 years, and they will work much of the time. But those kind of processes don't work very well when the flow is variable. Mechanical systems work best when you have a specific flow rate that you've designed them for, and then they work well. But if you go faster than that or slower than that, they often don't work very well and don't capture all of the oil. So that's an advantage of the technologies that I'm dealing with, is that they're really independent of flow rate and that sort of thing. But there are lots of different technologies. I think I mentioned walnut shell filters. They've been used for a long time. That's the kind of technology Granddad used, and it worked well for Granddad. But there's still 1-3% oil in the that's escaping from these processes, and that, as we look at the waste streams from the oil and gas industry, we're realizing that while we got most of the oil, we really want to capture more of it. We want to capture all of it, and that the economics can show that it's worthwhile doing that.
Okay. And then talking about those technologies, I mean, the ion exchange or OptiPore, I mean, to me, if you would ask me about reverse osmosis, I would say we are component supplier. And there is an OEMs, I mean, origin equipment manufacturing. There's another company who really take our technology and build the system for the end user like Shell or Total or Exxon. So is it the same case in your technology? Do you, I mean, there is OEMs who are really knowledgeable and they take out, I mean, Dow technology or DuPont technology and they build the systems?
Well, yes, there are. And that's what I referred to earlier. Is that I have been spending time developing relationships with OEMs who, and teaching them how the media works and how to properly design the equipment and the vessels. Since I'm in the U.S., a lot of that focus has been on companies here in the U.S. Not so much with companies overseas.
Right, because this, I just want to confirm this, because this, in my experience, I've been working also with, a couple of OEMs here in Europe and North Africa. And what I notice is there are key, let's say, I would call them mistakes, but there are some key technical hints that after 3-4 years, people change at the OEMs, new people come in, they ask the same question. And this leads me to ask you, is there kind of, let's say, key technical mistakes or key technical hints that the newcomers in those OEMs, they should keep in mind while working with OptiPore and ion exchange for produced water?
Well, yeah, there has to be good transfer of information. I stay in close contact with the OEMs that I work with because I understand how the products work. The way we typically operate is that I'll get a typical water sample from the end user, from the customer. And then I will develop what I call a conceptual design for that treatment. I like to figure out the dollars and cents before we do a lot of work, before we do a lot of testing. And because of experience that I've had, I was the co-inventor on one of the products, and I was the chief product steward, the product responsible person for the other product for a long time. So I have good knowledge of how these products work. And then I'll take that conceptual design that I put on a spreadsheet, and I'll turn that over to the equipment manufacturer. And they know how to build the equipment. They know how to build, and they've done enough of this now that they've got a pretty good handle on what it will cost to build that unit. And then we can take those two things together, capital cost of the equipment and the purchase cost of the media. And then I can fill in the operating cost information because of my understanding. And so before we've, bent a piece of pipe or done anything, we can have a good budgetary number on what it costs to treat that water. We'll have a very good idea of how clean we can make the water, what the qualities of the water will be, so that end user can then think about what they're going to do with that water, what the value proposition looks like for recovering the oil that's present and removing the hydrocarbons. So it's a good relationship, I think.
Right. So it's kind of explaining the details. I mean, the CapEx and OpEx before investing anything into the real plant. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. You want to do that on paper with the best information that you have. And then if it's of interest, then it's always okay to go back in and do some validation testing. The partners I work with now, we will do a series of more grab samples to be sure that we've got an accurate idea of what's going on with that produced water. You see, produced water is a waste, in the minds of most of the operators, and it'll vary widely. At disposal wells, for instance, it's coming in by truck or by pipeline, and if it's coming in by truck, each truckload will be different. So it's important to understand that variation so that you do a proper design on the treatment system. After you've done another round of sampling, often what we'll do is have the customer send a tote of water to the lab. And you got to do that quickly because this water will change very rapidly during shipping and storage. So you've got to have your ducks in order, so to speak, to get that done. And then the partners that I work with, they also have pilots available, 15 gallon per minute size pilots that can be taken out in the field and run for a week or 2 weeks or, whatever is desired. And that way, then, over that time frame, you get the averaging of the variation of the water, and you get a pretty good idea of the merits of the separation and the project.
Right. So this reminds me, I think, a similar story we had also, we do also in seawater application or brackish water applications. The only difference is, brackish water, seawater is so well known that sometimes, most of the time we don't need any pilot testing. But right. In the meantime, we ask the customer to give us, let's say, the variation of temperature within the four seasons. That's mm-hmm. one thing. The variation of the water chemistry within also four seasons. Because in the rain, if the water is coming from the dam, then the quality is different. Then you need to add antiscalant, to vary antiscalant. So we always keep in mind the worst case scenario that would happen in four seasons. And I would say the same thing in your case, I would say.
Yes. I think we can do much of this by projection and that sort of thing. But for many, this is a newer kind of technology. Yeah, I should say that the wicking resin for the suspended oil removal has been used at Dow for over 30 years. It was widely sold 30 years ago, and there are many installations around the world. In fact, many of them have been forgotten. We've lost track of them. And so we don't have a very good list of references of where the technology is used. Similarly, with OptiPore, that's used to remove the water-soluble hydrocarbons, the BTECs, from the water. That's a product that's been around for over 30 years. And it's very well understood, and we know how to design systems to use it. So we can do a lot of the conceptual design without having to do the pilots, without having to do that, because that pilots all take time. But sometimes customers want to see with their own eyes to validate themselves and do their own testing on the treated water to be sure that it's exactly what they want.
Yeah. So Bob, when you say, you do the conceptual design. So when you work with a customer and then you understand the feed water quality, I'm talking in the past when you were with Dow Chemical, mm-hmm. Did you had sometimes kind of you take a little bit step farther? You say, okay, this is the water quality. The first time I have seen this water quality is challenging, and then you give back. Okay, can I tweak this ion exchange in such a way to extract this component? Have you had this situation in the past?
Yeah, that's been my career of technical service and new product development. That's the long definition of TS&D. So we do technical support and try to solve problems for customers with products that we already have. That's the best for the customer, and that's the best for the media supplier. But in some cases, we don't have a solution for them. And then it's a question of, you know, how big is this opportunity? Is it a problem worth solving? And then if it is, to identify a solution. And I've done that countless times in my career and still doing it today as a consultant.
Right. And then talking about, I mean, Aptipor specifically in this ion exchange, which extracts, I mean, recover the oil, the fuel percentage. I mean, which futures that you think are still not yet developed or maybe still not yet adopted on ion exchange when it comes to treating produced water?
Treating produced water really depends on the end use of the water. How is this water going to be reused? You see, you don't need very sophisticated high level of water treatment if you're just going to put it back down a hole and do enhanced oil recovery. That, you know, you don't want to do things that you don't need to do. It's like the old Groucho Marx joke. I'm sorry, I might be dating myself. I don't even know who Groucho Marx is, but you know, he'd go to the doctor and say, "Doctor, it hurts when I do that." And Groucho, the doctor, would twiddle his cigar and say, "Well, don't do that." So you want to use the treatments that are appropriate to the water and the ultimate use of the water. If you're just going to clean it up to dispose of it, then you want to grab as much oil as you can that's practical and economical, and you want to think about protecting your disposal well. That's it. That's all you want to do. If, on the other hand, the salinity is fairly low, or you want to make salt out of this water, or you want to look in the water for something else that might be there, then you need a more sophisticated treatment, because those end stage treatments, whether you're making rock salt, evaporating the water off, or using some of the new technologies to remove water, or you're doing reverse osmosis, those things need to be protected from that oil and grease in particular.
Okay, so if I understood correctly, I mean, the ion exchange and Aptipor, I mean, those technologies, they are kind of mature enough, they don't need any further development or any new futures for the produced water. They are well enough, I mean, for produced water.
Well, in any of these things, you're always looking for lower cost. In the end, once you've met the technical requirements for a customer from one technology A, B, or C, the decision comes down to which one is the lower cost, which is the one most reliable, and that sort of thing. Certainly in the equipment arena, there are always ways of producing the equipment less expensive to reduce the CapEx. There are ways to improve the OpEx by improving reliability and getting uptime as high as possible and that sort of thing. But in terms of really new things that are needed, sure, there's probably things that could be done. Nothing comes to mind right now in terms of what that might be.
Okay, good. And I think a lot of those things, you really well frame, I mean, the TSND job. And most of, I would say, in my experience, most of good ideas comes when I get interaction with the customers in the real plants, when discussing with operators and engineers, and then you really to discuss, let's say, I would say the real feedback about technology, and then you came up with an idea how to tweak that technology in such a way to meet the needs of the customer, and at the end of the day, it will help them to optimize OPEX and CAPEX. And because for me, it's very interesting, the feedback of the customer. And this is maybe I can ask you, I mean, do you see that, you know, a feedback coming from the customer who really uses technology every day, is it something essential for enhancement and development of the product in general, I would say?
Yeah, absolutely. Developing solutions is a partnership. You have to have somebody that understands the process and what the end user is doing, and then someone else that understands the options, the chemistry, the science of doing this. I'm reminded of one of my professors, Dr. Clyde Frank, at the University of Iowa, and he'd say, "Remove calcium," and we say, "Okay, if you wanted to remove calcium from water, you'd take one approach." But then he'd say, "No, remove calcium from milk." Okay, it's a fluid, but it's a whole different separation. Okay, so the matrix, the what the customer's dealing with, how they're doing it, is this water flow that they're dealing with continuous, or is it intermittent? Is it here and stops and goes? What's the temperature and all the other physical and properties that go into that? They're all very important, and it requires a partnership in order to solve the problem.
Okay, that's very good. And then Bob, it's very good insight, and this brings me to the one of the two last questions. I mean, the first one is, you have talked about, you know, technology that treats produce water. There are several of them. I mean, Aptipor, Ion Exchange, and you said, of course, it is also other technology which can also treat. I mean, each technology has its weakness and strength, I would say. Mm-hmm. Do you see any emerging, something just new in the market, and you believe it might a little bit shift the produced water treatment in the future? Something is very new, very emerging technology.
Yeah, I was talking to one of my colleagues just yesterday, and they've developed a polymer that will extract water out of very high TDS produced water. So if you've got a very salty water stream, you can use this polymer to extract the water out, and of course you be making a super saturated solution of the salts so that they can fall out. It's still in early stages development and that sort of thing, but that will be an interesting technology going forward. Gosh, you can just go to any of the meetings and hear about some of these new developments that are going on with water purification.
That's very interesting. And this leads me to the last question, Bob. I mean, are you, if I understood correctly, you're active in a charitable organization. Have you done any humanitarian water projects now? Or are you active in those, in humanitarian water,
yeah,
water projects?
Yeah, I've got a couple different projects. I was just consulting some local students here in town that had a summer program that was led by Michigan State University to remove fluoride from drinking water. Fluoride is important to, and we typically add it to drinking water to help have good health of your teeth. But in some places in the world, there's too much and it causes problems for them. So I was helping these students remove fluoride from water. I was helping them design the tests. They were doing all the work, but I was consulting for them. Another big problem is PFAS in the water. That's the perfluorinated compounds that were used in all kinds of products that we use, consumer products today, for waterproofing of materials. It was used as a firefighting foam and that sort of thing. And I'm helping some guys on PFAS, and then just general drinking water treatment and purification, advising people. Sometimes they get sold a bill of goods. Somebody will say, well, you need to buy this expensive piece of equipment to treat this water to make it safe for people to drink. And I point out, you know, you can just drill a well, properly drilled well that's properly cemented in and properly finished so that you don't have an intrusion of surface water down the borehole. All that kind of thing is just the kind of advice I'm happy to help people understand and treat water.
But that's interesting, Bob. You said PFAS. If I understood correctly, you said there's already technology that can treat water with PFAS.
Yeah, so PFAS is something that we're finding out that's in the water. It was either got there by firefighters putting out fires, and of course they have to practice too. So that stuff ended up in the waterways and lakes and things like that. It's also was in products that we used and then went into the garbage. And perfluorinated compounds have been around for 40 years, 50 years, something like that. So they've ended up in all of these different places. So I'm consulting with people on how to remove these kind of compounds from water.
That's very good. Thank you very much, Bob. And the last question, if the audience would like to get in touch with you, can they reach you in LinkedIn or through which social media?
I'm on LinkedIn. My email address is bobgoltz@gmail.com.
Good. Thank you very much, Bob. Thanks a lot for the discussion. It was a very interesting discussion, and I wish you a good day.
Good. Thank you very much, Hakeem. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.